Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Education, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Trevor Matea, one of your hosts on the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Federico R. Vaitoller about his book, Excluded by Choice, Urban Students with Disabilities in the Education Marketplace. Federico, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to begin our conversation today by having you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work.
Yeah. So I am a professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago. My research focuses on urban inclusive education. I'm interested about urban policies and how they affect the inclusion and educational experiences, particularly of Black and Latinx students with disabilities. Formerly, I was a preschool teacher for many years back in the day. I was a Spanish teacher in elementary school. And then I did a master's in special education and became a special ed teacher, work with kids with identify with emotional and behavioral disorders, and then did my PhD in University of Arizona and began to do research on inclusive schools and racial inequities within that movement.
How did you come to write Excluded by Choice?
It's been the work. I mean, it's interesting because a book comes out and people doesn't realize it's the work of almost 5 years. You know, if I count that from the moment where I started the project and designing it, interviewing people and publishing other articles. So it's been until I got to this book, it's been about 5 years. And it came at an interest because I saw in the research and the literature on educational policy a very big vacuum on attentions to students with disabilities, particularly with a race lens. When you look at the literature on school choice, particularly you either or charter schools, you either see articles that talks about racial inequities, and or you see articles that just merely talks about test scores and which school has the best test scores, and then you see another line of articles that may look at some of the issues with disabilities. Most of this research is about the enrollment patterns, inclusion patterns, but it's very, very superficial. And so because my work, it's based on intersections of race and disability, I wanted to write a book that portrays the particular experiences of, in this case, of Black and Latinx students within the school choice movement. Students from different racial backgrounds will have qualitatively different experiences than those, for example, who are students with disabilities who are white.
I appreciated learning that before you became an education researcher, you yourself were a teacher in both preschools and elementary schools. I'm wondering what experiences you've had, either as a student yourself or during your teaching or research career, have most shaped your views on schools?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I worked in Seattle for a few years, and I remember two things that really shaped me. One was working in two different schools, one in upper neighborhood, what's called, still called probably Upper Queen Anne, and another one, a school in the neighborhood, which was a more affluent neighborhood, and it was a school that had a lot of resources, and a lot of technology and different support for teachers and so forth, but also work in a different school in a neighborhood that has completely been gentrified now. But in that moment, it was a school that had a history of racial segregation, and it was a stark difference because in one school they have, you know, this amazing blackboard and so forth, and in the other school there were transparency projector. You had an engine, you know, they made so much noise you could barely talk in the classroom, you know. And the two differences between the schools were startling, right? Like the book of Savage Inequalities. And that was something that marked how two schools in the same city could have, even within the same school district, could have such a different context. Could be such a different context. And the second one was working with students with disabilities and beginning to know, working in schools, that most of students, particularly who were sending or identified with emotional behavioral disorders, were either Black or from racial minority Blackwell. So that kind of awakened my interest to begin to look at issues of race within a special education. And then I went on to study a little more about issues of overrepresentation and racial inequities within the special education system.
In the title of your book, you use the phrase education marketplace. Some of our listeners may also be familiar with the idea of school choice. I was wondering if you could define those terms.
Yeah, no, school choice, I mean, it's part of a marketplace. It's a policy that, or a series of policies that enable to have an educational marketplace. But, you know, school choice can go back even to the 1950s. Milton Friedman pushing for marketized way of delivering public school, but they really began to gain momentum in the late 1990s. And the idea is that of school choice is that school districts offer a portfolio of school options for families that includes neighborhood schools, charter schools, magnets, selective enrollment, turnarounds, and maybe other specialty schools, including military schools. And parents get to choose the school that they want for their child. I mean, this is the theory, right? As my book demonstrates, from theory to practice, there is a huge gap. But the idea is that parents get to choose the best fitting school for the students according to the data that received through test scores and graduation rates and safety indicators that they may see. And according to the data, students, parents make a choice for their children. And this consumer behavior, because in this kind of policy, parents are treated as consumers. In this consumer behavior, the idea is that it will help to improve schools over time. One is because schools will strive to improve their quality to compete for students, and schools that do not perform well, or they have going to lose students and lose enrollment, and maybe close either for underperformance or for underutilization. For example, in Chicago, since the 2000, the school district have closed over 100 schools due to underperformance or underutilization. And only the best schools would be leave for parents. So this, over time, this consumer behavior is supposed to improve the educational experiences of all students and give options to, particularly to low-income families that they may not have had before. This school choice, it's part of a market-driven educational policy. And the idea of a market-driven educational policy is an educational policy that incorporates some elements of capitalism in their design, in this case, consumer behavior, competition, flexibility. So they are slightly different, but I think one encompasses the other one. And it brings this idea of making school districts, particularly, an education marketplace where parents can shop about supposedly the best school for their children.
And I'll be interested a little bit later in our conversation to hear you talk more about the gap between the theory underlying the education marketplace and how parents navigate that new system in practice. First, yeah. Your book focuses on urban students with disabilities. Could you talk a little bit about the range of disabilities affecting students in American public schools, as well as the subset of those students who you focus on in the book?
Yeah, I mean, there are several policies that affect students with disabilities in schools, and each policy has a different disability definition. The most encompassing and I think powerful policy for providing services to students with disabilities is the Individuals with Disability Education Act. And the Individuals with Disability Education Act requires students to be identified within these 12 disability categories, and those range from students with mild specific learning disabilities, for example, a student who may struggle with math or with reading, decoding words, or it could go all the way to more severe disabilities of students who may not be able to communicate, or students who may have cognitive disabilities. And there's a range. So there's 12 categories. I'm not going to name them, but there are about 12 categories. But the range is very broad. Then you may have a disability. You may be a student with a disability, and you may not be served under ADA. You may have a, what is it called, a 504 plan that comes from the Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which means you have a not so comprehensive plan, and you don't receive fully special education services, but you still have a plan that keeps the school from discriminating students with disabilities and providing you some services. So the range is very broad, and you can be a student with disabilities and not receive special education services.
So what resources are available for supporting students with disabilities in either district, neighborhood, public schools versus the charter schools that their families might later enroll them in?
Yeah, the system is the same. There are charter schools and neighborhood schools and magnet schools, and any school that receives public funding, are they need to comply with the IDEA, the Individuals with Disability Education Act mandate. So if a student is identified for special education, the student will have what's called an IEP, an individualized educational program, in where they have the services that students would receive according to their individual needs. And those services could be from specialized instruction in a different environment or within the general education classroom to having services such as speech pathologies, occupational therapies, school counselors, nurses. It depends on the needs and the supports that the student's going to need to succeed in a school. So there's a wide range of services that students can receive. And both charter schools, neighborhood schools, any school that receives public funding needs to provide these services.
And so it sounds like if you're a family with a student who has a disability, in terms of the services, your experience should be similar regardless of what type of school you're enrolled in. Is that correct? Is that actually true in people's lived experiences?
Yeah, the core of the services should be the same. Whether you go to a charter school or a neighborhood school, you should entitle to your individualized educational program. One, that IEP, what's called an IEP, it's written. That becomes a legal document. That can become almost a contract between the family and the school district that needs to be follow, regardless if you are in a charter school or a neighborhood school or any sort of school.
It occurs to me that families might be looking for something other than services provided, especially if those can be provided in a range of schools. And so in your research, what have you found that families are typically looking for in their school experience?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. One of the chapters of my book, or two chapters of my book, deals with that in depth. And what I found is not just what they need now. I think these so-called choices that families have, they need to understand with this historical context of urban development. They need to be understood as families who have lived in areas that first were marked by state-sanctioned racial segregation, followed by years of disinvestment and abandonment from city governments. And that, of course, gets translated to the schools that are offered in those areas of the city. So parents come with all these histories with them when they make school choices. They don't make just school choices on a present, rational, cognitive way. But there is a set of emotions, and I think the book does a very effective job showing the range of emotions related to this history of disinvestment and racial segregation, and also exclusion for students with disabilities and lack of service for students with disabilities. And when parents make choices, because the parents, if the book does provide a critique to charter schools, it does also provide a critique to all schools, because these parents, the parents that are in the book, they have very poor experiences in all schools. And that's one of the reasons they ended up in a charter school. So some of them are looking just for safety. So some of them are just looking for a safe space to send their children with a disability, because they're being bullied or they've been victims of violence in other schools. And also they're afraid because they are a child with disability. They're more likely to be picked on and be a victim of bullying. So they're very concerned about the schools around them. Other parents perceive that charter schools have more resources because charter schools have market themselves in that way. So when you are in a neighborhood or in a school where you have poor experiences with special education services, with lack of services, with schools that are closing due to underperformance or underutilization, with destabilization of the district, with lack with racial segregation, then you come these new schools coming into the same areas of the city that that's what's happening, and with new teachers, with new schools, telling you they have small student teacher ratios, which is in contrast to the larger teacher student ratios of neighborhood schools, and they say they can include their student with a disability into their programming. So parents, it's very hopeful for parents when this come about. And in the book, I show how these charter schools also are very aggressive, in some way, to recruit these parents. And they pursue them, and they go to child cares, and they go to fairs, and they want to bring them in. So parents are lured and are excited about this new possibility. So I don't think a lot of literature talks about, oh, it's because the test scores, because that. Yeah, that has to do. And the book talks about that. Some parents were excited about the possibility to access college, because a lot of these charter schools market themselves as, 100% success to sending kids to college. But there is also this historical layer of historical disappointment and the history of these neighborhoods, and how these schools have served students with disabilities in these racially segregated environments that highly affect the way that parents make decisions, which are very emotional, they're not just cognitive, rational, individual decisions, but they're very emotional, very historical, and very spatial too, because they're shaped by how their particular neighborhoods have been developed over time.
Can you speak a little bit about the process of applying and enrolling in a charter school? What is involved in that?
It depends on the city, it depends on the state, it depends on who granted the charter. So every state has different laws about this. I can speak specifically in general. In Chicago, if you apply and there are open seats in the charter school, you should be able to get in. A student should be able to get in. If there are no spaces, you should go to a lottery system. Now, this, it's a little tricky, and then it becomes a little fussy. Why? Because how charters market themselves may be able to allure certain kind of families or bring in certain kind of families and students and try to avoid to market to other families. This tends to happen if charter schools are very full, so they're more maybe selective on the ways that they market themselves and who they try to pursue to come to the charter schools. It's different when the charter schools need to fill up seats. And a lot of the students of my book, I think that was their experience. Charter schools needed to fill up seats, and they were very active and aggressive in recruiting students and bring them in the charter schools so they could demonstrate or they could show that the school was being filled. So it can depend.
And for the families that you followed in your book, what were their experiences like once enrolled in charter schools? So were their initial hopes realized? Were they disappointed, or a mix of the two?
I think mostly were disappointed. The parents that enter very excited with a lot of optimism and hope to these new charter schools, they found that first the charter schools were not fully prepared to serve students with disabilities. They didn't have the services for them. They also found that because these schools strive to this high academic and high disciplinary, high academic achievement and high strict discipline, they found that those practices that were rigorous and rigid were very detrimental to their child, that could not follow such rigorous and intensive academics and also such rigorous and strict disciplinary policies. And students struggle a lot, and there's a whole chapter called The Consequences that demonstrating that the consequences, not just parents leave to another school, but actually students are emotionally and psychologically harmed by these practices. And also very important, charter schools have high turnover teacher rates. And this affected also the services received students and communication with parents. So it also affected the kind of educational experience they have. There were some also violations of the IEPs, schools who did not provide what the IEP was saying to the student, or trying to change the IEP to provide less services. So there was a combination of less resources, less support, a bigger push and pressure for achievement, more disciplinary and strict measures with unqualified staff, which provided the recipe for a very ableist environment for students with disabilities.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the legal implications of the current education marketplace structure. And so it sounds to me from some of the things that you've said is that some of these charter schools may be violating the law, or they may be unable to provide the services that they would legally be required to if they were a neighborhood public school. Can you help me understand that better?
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, in some cases there were a direct violation of the law, like when a charter school or a charter school administrator or a teacher does not follow the student IEP and are not, for example, given the amount of minutes of a particular service, they're violating. That's a violation of IDEA. There are other areas that are very gray. Because what happened with the marketplace of education or a school choice is that it's framed as a parental choice. So if you're a parent and you're not being served well in school, well, you always have the choice to go to another school. So many parents left the charter school. Some parents stay because they didn't have any other viable option, which is another very interesting finding. But half of the parents left the charter schools and they leave. And when they leave, well, it's their choice to leave. It's framed as their choice to leave, but it's not really a choice, right? Because they have very poor experiences in the charter school to a point that it was a very hostile environment for the child and the family. But it's framed in this rationale of marketplace as, well, if the parents leave, it's their choice. It's their choice. That's the reason the play on words on the book. They're excluded by choice. They want to leave. So that's a little fuzzy area for the law, because school choice have created this gray area of one is really parental choice to leave a school, and one is students that are really being pushed out because the practice of the school. And you know, and many administrators told to my participants, you know, you could stay. It's your choice to stay, but you're going to be better serving another school. Or they would tell them, we'll suspend your child and we kick them out of school, but if you move to a neighbor's school, we delete the expulsion on his record. Or we'll tell them, we don't have a speech pathology, so we cannot serve your child, but the neighborhood school can. You'll be better there. So there was this very suggestion to parents to choose what was best, quotation marks, for their child. But really what was going on, they were pushing parents out.
That anecdote you just shared, or that scenario you shared about a student whose IEP entitles them to services provided by a speech pathologist. They enroll in a charter school that doesn't have a speech pathologist on staff. To be clear, that school is not legally obligated to hire one or to contract with one?
It depends on the relationship between the charter school and the district. If the district is the authorizer of the charter school, well, the full responsibility for the student is the district. So any problem that a student with disability, any legal problem a student with disability have at the charter school, CPS is responsible. Because it's the district which is responsible to provide those services. So what is supposed to happen, or sometimes tends to happen, is that the charter school will communicate with the district, and the district will help them out to, or send them a speech pathologist or some service that the charter schools may not have.
And so as I'm kind of listening to you speak about this, it seems to me that charter schools are privileged in a way that the district schools are not. I mean, they get some of the advantages, you know, of increasing their student body, you know, to receive more funding. But then students who require more services, they can push out and, you know, not be burdened by providing those services that a district is legally obligated to. I mean, is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, in general, charter schools have been accused and there's some evidence, including my book, that have been pushing out students with disabilities. And I think they're trapped in this paradox. I don't know if you call it paradox, but it's like a double bind. Because in a sense, they're marketing themselves as this highly rigorous, rigid, strict disciplinary schools with high achievement. And some students with disabilities don't fit within that market identity of those charter schools. So when a student with disability enters such charter school, if the charter school doesn't have those services, the charter school has some, or needs to become more flexible on their practices. But by being more flexible on these highly rigorous standards, they're also kind of diluting their own identity within the marketplace, because that's how they market themselves. So I think that they're faced a double bind, in a sense of trying to serve the students while their market identity and what entice parents to come in, it means a very different school experience that these students need.
I'm also wondering whether you anticipate we'll have charters in their current form in 20 years, given more recent conversations about systemic racism and maybe some pushback on the strict academic or social protocols that some of these schools might have in place. So what do you foresee for charter schools in the future?
Yeah, I mean, let me address you, so that charter schools still continue to serve a large proportion of Black and Latinx students. If you see the proportions, particularly Black students are disproportionately enrolled in charter schools compared to neighborhood schools. And that's also true in the special education system of both schools. But you bring an interesting issue. I've been thinking about this year, of course, with all the social unrest and activism against police brutality. And I think this book takes a new meaning on this context as well, because even though the book doesn't treat about police brutality, it does address, as you say, these highly strict disciplinary measures, very punitive, that students experience. There are likewise some of this idea that certain people from certain races deserve to be treated with more violence because that's what they need to improve, right? Mm-hmm. And that also has a spatial dimension because it also has the imaginaries of certain spaces on the city, certain neighborhoods, which are portrayed and discursively constructed as unruly and dangerous. And therefore, they need these schools with very strict disciplinary practices to turn the students around, right? I'm not supporting the narrative, but I'm saying that that narrative is constructive in order to justify the expansion of charter schools in those areas.
Do you anticipate new pushback against the creation of new charter schools as families might be paying more closer attention to police brutality and an overly punitive disciplinary system in schools?
I will hope so. I will hope that, and I don't want to put all charter schools in this bag. Let's say this, the large majority of charter schools in big cities are corporate network charter schools, and they tend to follow some of these strict disciplinary procedures. But there are some charter schools that know that there are single community-based charter schools that are different kind of work. So I think we need to separate that as well. But in these schools, which are the most schools, at least in Chicago and in urban centers, that follow these strict disciplinary procedures, I would hope there would be a more of a pushback and people would think twice about approving schools that, there was a network like 4 or 5 years ago, even when I was interviewing participants, they were charging parents every time the students misbehave. And also acquiring demerits for children. And I think these punitive measures need to change. We know punishing students doesn't work. There is since the 1970s, we have a plethora of research about positive behavior supports. But it seems that these charter schools, this model of charter schools, has been stuck in this like 1960s, 1970s, or earlier mentality that you can learn by punishing people.
So if I'm the parent of a Black child with a disability and I'm looking to enroll her in a charter school, in the city where I live, and, you know, I find schools with high test scores, by that metric, it looks like it will be an improvement upon their experience in our neighborhood public school. And so I am, in conversation with teachers and administrators in various charters, and I'm touring those charter schools. What would you suggest I look for when I'm on those campuses? And what questions would you suggest that I ask those staff members so that, to better ensure that our experience is a positive one, we make the right choice, and I don't have to unenroll my child the following year?
Yeah, well, I think it's very important to have a buy from the school. Do you see highly strict disciplinary measures? Do you think do you see teachers when you walk by or administrators or school staff redirecting and punishing children in different ways? Do the school policies have any sort of punish-based regulation? Are the services that your child needs provided in that school? Are teachers' experience and in teaching and including students with disabilities? Are the assistive technologies needed for your child to succeed? Are the instructional practices based on universal design for learning principles that provides a way flexible framework for different kinds of students to learn together? So I'd be looking for those things. I wouldn't pay too much attention to high test scores or high access to college, because that could in the end, that could mean certain pressure for students with little supports.
It sounds very difficult for parents who aren't educators themselves to navigate this. I mean, your suggestions make sense to me as a former teacher, but many of those things that I would have never heard of, I think, you know, universal design for learning, had I not been a teacher myself, occurs to me, it's like the idea of a marketplace doesn't make a lot of sense in current form, because if you view families as consumers, they're uneducated consumers. And so they're not making lasting, satisfying choices, at least in many cases.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not the same. You make an excellent point. I mean, it's not the same to choose a school that go to a supermarket and choose a brand of cereal, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same process. For once, you need a lot of knowledge and understanding about how to choose a school for your children if you're going to go tour and many schools. And you need to have the time to do that, too. This takes a lot of time. If you want to, like, tour several schools, check them out. And even the tours for students with disabilities. I mean, I've been doing other research with some activist groups in Chicago. And what we found is that these tours really don't offer any information for parents with disabilities. So even you can go to the school tours, but get very little information about their special ed services. So the idea that I can make an informed, rational decision, I think is fraud.
What recommendations do you have from for policymakers to improve and address some of the issues you've identified?
Yeah, I know the last chapter, I get a long last chapter giving very specific recommendations. Some of the recommendations for policymakers are how we approve and reauthorize charter schools. And I give a series of recommendations from ensuring that there is community participation, ensuring that schools provide have the resources to serve students with disabilities, that their school practices are based in universal design principles, that they are also offer an anti-racist and cultural sustaining pedagogy as their model for teaching students rather than a punitive one. I propose to look at issues of school-wide positive, cultural responsive positive behavior support systems. So the book, that's a long list and gets into details on some of these recommendations. But bottom line, I think we need to pay much more attention to how we approve and reauthorize charter schools and think what we want charter schools to do. I think one of the problems is policymakers were just being interested in schools that improve test scores and college attendance scores. And I think this is a very narrow and dangerous way to privilege some schools and support some schools and not others.
And if readers could have just one takeaway from the book, what would you hope it would be?
A couple of things that I think people should take away from my book. One is that this idea of a school choice is not the idea that parents and consumers can make informed decisions and school choice. I think it's not such, we cannot take it such as a cognitive and individual choice phenomenon, but we need to look at how the history of the neighborhoods where parents live and their history of emotions and relationship with these neighborhoods play a role in selecting schools and in being enticed by charter schools. I think that's an important message of the book, and particularly looking at the intersections of race and disability, how parents who have been who have experienced racial segregation, but also segregation in terms of disability in schools and lack of resources for students with disabilities, perceive neighborhood schools very differently than other parents. And another important message, I think, is that we need to move away from this punitive system in charter schools for students with disabilities and Black and Latinx students in general. And we need to move into a more justice-based, cultural sustaining, and universally designed system of practices where students can enter the door without having to leave their identities, and they're not being punished for who they are, but actually they are being, their identities are being sustained and developing in a healthy way. And finally, I think we need to improve all schools. If we would have great neighborhood schools, we wouldn't be talking about school choice. So we need to continue to resource and think the ways that students with disabilities are served in all schools, not just charter schools.
What are three other books you might recommend to our listeners who have enjoyed our conversation and enjoy Excluded by Choice?
Ghost in the Schoolyard, a book by Eve Ewing. I will recommend Cultural Sustaining Pedagogies by Django Paris and Sally Alim. I would recommend also a classic like Savage Inequalities, talking about differences in a school by Kossel.
Finally, can you tell us a little bit about your next project and how we can follow your work?
Yeah, so my next project, we are analyzing the data right now, and we did a similar study, but we focused more on how parents made choices, and we didn't focus only on Latinx and Black students, but we focus on a more wide range of racial, parents with wide range of racial background, and also different areas of the city. So we're trying to understand how disability, race, and geographical location interact to shape how parents make choices about schools.
Federico, I really appreciate the work that you're doing. As a teacher who's worked in both district and charter schools, I know how important it is. And I want to thank you for being on our show today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.